Today, can the property market python swallow the equity elephant? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the posts covering finance and property news. In my post yesterday, the live show with Leith Van Onselen, I touched on my recent research relating to the massive amount of equity that's been created within the property market. And today I want to take that conversation a little further by looking at some data and also diving into some of the underlying factors that we should be thinking about. This, for me, is a really important conversation. And it's one that I think is not being covered, particularly in the mainstream media, very well. And I'll make an initial point here. I have one-to-one conversations with a lot of people about what they're trying to do, not from a financial advice perspective, but from a general conversation perspective. And it amazed me over the last 6 to 12 months how many times this question of the intergenerational wealth problem came up. So I think this is a real issue. And so let's try and get into some of the real data here. And of course, because I'm also surveying now in the UK, as well as Australia, what we can do is we can compare and contrast the differences in these two different parts of the world, because there are some similarities, but there are also some quite significant differences, not least to do with tax and the way that tax is treated, particularly in the UK. And again, this isn't tax advice, this isn't financial advice, but it's a general observation about what it means to the property elephant when it's being swallowed by a python, effectively. And this is a very lumpy, large elephant stuck in the middle of the python. It's going through the generations. And the question is, what's going to happen? There's a couple of data points here. The first is, if you look at home price changes from, let's say, the year 2000, in Australia, it's nearly 400% up. In the UK, it's about 251% up. So in other words, four times. So we've seen a massive acceleration of home prices over a couple of generations. The second point is that when you actually look at this and you say, okay, so what are the consequences for that? Well, it's $11+ trillion in Australia in the property sector, right? That's houses and apartments and investment properties, right? Compare that with about $4 trillion within superannuation and around $2.5 trillion in the stock market. So this is by far the biggest asset pool anywhere. And what it means is a lot of people are sitting on, big, at least paper gains on their property. But the really interesting point here is when you start looking at this, it's not equally distributed. So when you actually start looking at where is that wealth actually sitting, the truth is a lot of it's sitting amongst older households, a lot of those bought when properties were, three times income being the typical mortgage. Now it's what, eight times in some cases. So people were able to get in more easily. And quite often it was on a single income rather than two incomes and two full-time incomes now. So we've got this situation where, because of the developments in the property market, this bubble of value is sitting not uniformly spread, but actually in particular households' balance sheets. Now, when you start looking in more detail, it's quite similar in the UK. It's just not quite as excessive, but it's still very large. But a lot of these households are now getting to the point of moving into retirement, and in fact, beyond retirement, which then begs the question, what happens? What happens when ultimately people fall off the perch? Or what happens when people decide that it's time to downsize and to move into smaller property? And what does this all also mean for those first-time buyers who are trying to get into the market as prices are walking further away from them? And even with the interest rate cuts, if you look at affordability versus buying a property, it's more adverse than it's been for a generation or two. So to what extent does that intergenerational wealth then come into play, either via the bank of mum and dad, or indeed you wait until people fall off the perch and then you get an inheritance? And there was a very interesting piece of research from the Productivity Commission who showed that there's about $6 trillion of intergenerational wealth incoming over the next years, and other people who've done work on this in the wealth management area is suggesting even a bigger number. So what does it mean? And where is that going to go? And does that mean that more people will be able to access the property market because of the intergenerational wealth? Or does it actually distort the market even more? Because the question really is an interesting one. Where does that intergenerational wealth go? And the fact is that we've got this massive asset bubble sitting in property. Now, I say it's an asset bubble because if you know, I've had this conversation for a long, long time. If you look at long-term trends and relative to, you know, income levels and property, the gap between affordability and property prices is more extreme than it's ever been. And of course, a lot of the government announcements recently, Labour coming back into power, of course, again, will exacerbate it further, particularly enabling first-time buyers to get in and interest rates are coming down. So the chances are we're going to see property prices going even higher. The question is, what does this do to the overall situation? And my point is, there's a lot of focus on the first-time buyer part of the conversation, but this intergenerational wealth, you know, massive wave, to my mind, is going to actually put potentially another rocket under property too. I think there's a very significant couple of data points. The first is, if you look at the data, around 82% of inheritance by value lands on people who are over 50. So the bulk of it is handing down to kids, right? So it's not coming down necessarily directly to the 20-year-olds and the 30-year-olds who are trying to get into the property market. So that's the first point. The second point is, when you talk to people who are getting into that sort of next stage of life, so they've retired and you know, their incomes are perhaps a little bit more compressed than they were, but they want to stay where they are. They don't want to move into other areas where they don't know anybody. And so they're sitting in these large properties. And in some cases, what they're trying to do is to downsize within the area that they know. But that's really difficult because quite often they're living in large properties, perhaps, you know, properties that are actually 4 or 5 bedrooms, you know, large plot of land, et cetera, et cetera. But in the same area, there are not smaller properties or even apartments that actually are attractive enough. So you've got a lot of people hanging around in these large properties, right, and not actually moving into smaller properties until they get to the point where perhaps they physically can't manage the property. And in some cases, what they then do is move into you know, retirement facilities of some sort, although I think that's a whole other ball game. And I've had a couple of conversations recently with people who actually some time ago made the decision to go into the you know, the retirement context and signed these contracts. And when you look at them and you think, well, that's madness. What you're doing is you're giving away so much. Yeah. You don't necessarily have control about the facilities that you have. And in fact, quite often what they promise to provide isn't what is provided. And in some cases, there's been a transfer of the ownership of the retirement context, whether it's a village or whether it's you know, a particular unit, to somebody else, and it's not being run very well. There are huge issues here. The other point about here is some people, of course, are persuaded to do reverse mortgages. Okay, I'm going to receive an income from my property. I paid it off, but I'm going to receive an income. And over time, the value then effectively gets transferred to the provider of the reverse mortgage. And so when you come to actually looking at the estate at the end of the day, suddenly it's a lot smaller than people thought it was. And it's interesting, I had a conversation the other day with some youngsters who'd assumed that their parents were well off. But the only reason that they were well off was because they'd done this reverse mortgage. They had zero available, and that was a complete shock. So it shows you that once you start teasing apart these various elements, there are hidden thematics that, again, like I say, aren't being discussed in the mainstream that need to be discussed, because this is such a big and complex issue. It's becoming a matter of you know, least worst option. The reverse mortgages that are sold now are sold that effectively you have lifetime occupancy of the property. So that you know, the provider of the mortgage is basically taking a gamble on how long you're going to live, right? That's what they're actually doing. And so you can only leverage up to a certain proportion of the value of the property over time. But it provides, you know, a significant income for some people. But I've always believed that this is something that you need to be really, really careful about. And, you know, sometimes people get into this situation where they're asset rich and cash flow poor. And so this looks like an attractive proposition, but I think people should be very careful. But if you look at the distribution of the value of property and the mortgages that are actually supporting that property, you see an inverse relationship. In other words, younger households have higher mortgages. On the other hand, if you go up the generations, what you see is a preponderance of much higher value of the property and a falling or zero debt. It's an asymmetric distribution across the generations, and it's inversely related. So that's the first point. The second is it's not uniformly spread across the country, because of course property values are different. You know, compare something out in the bush relative to, for example, the centre of Sydney or you know, Vaucluse or somewhere like that. It's a very different story. And so the value, the theoretical paper value, and I keep saying this, the theoretical paper value of what's there, is you know, huge. By the way, you don't know what the value of your property is until you actually come to crystallize it, right? And sometimes people get a nice surprise, but sometimes people also get a nasty surprise. So that's just worth bearing in mind. The third point, though, is that because of this intergenerational wealth conundrum, quite a few younger people are looking over their shoulder at their maybe their parents or maybe their grandparents, and looking at all that equity, thinking, gee, if only I could get my hands on a little bit of that now, that would allow me to get into the property market. And this takes us directly into the question of the bank of mum and dad, or as I've really called it, the family bank, because the family bank is a very active element in this at the moment. And if you've got a lot of equity sitting around in your property, and you've got youngsters trying to get into the property market, guess what? There's a conversation which many people are having. Now, whether it's a good conversation and whether it's a right conversation, different story. But this is part of this intergenerational conundrum that we're looking at here. And with youngsters finding it really, really difficult and delaying formation of families, delaying having kids, delaying buying a property by maybe 10 years from where it was a couple of generations ago, then this huge pool of wealth that's sitting out there is like, you know, the light on the hill, as it were. Final point, just quickly. In the superannuation system, people are paying $35 billion plus a year on fees to those in the superannuation system, right? Now, I would argue that we've got precisely the same, you know, another light on the hill from those who are thinking about how, from a financial system perspective, they might be able to profit from this too. And I'm worried that we're going to see more and more and more focus on advice, helping people to release some of this equity, right? I can just see advisors popping up left, right, and center. And again, I'm worried that a lot of people are going to pay a lot of money for stuff that isn't actually necessarily that helpful. And if you look at my latest surveys on the Bank of Mum and Dad, about half of first-time buyers are getting help from the Bank of Mum and Dad, as high as it's almost been. And the average amount that's being handed across, if you think of, you know, the cash element of a transaction, is well over $120,000 now, higher in Sydney, little lower in some other areas. So it's quite a big number. And in some cases, it's a lot higher than that. So it is a thing. Unfortunately, quite often, these arrangements are informal, and it's not clear whether, in fact, the money that's being handed across is a loan or whether it's actually a gift. It raises questions about, you know, what happens if parents need help later on? Do you get it back or do you not get it back? What happens if you've got siblings? Do they all get the same access to the same help? Very importantly, of course, the issue of relationship formation and collapse amongst youngsters is also a very interesting thing. So what happens if you get help from the bank of mum and dad, you buy a house together, and then the relationship falters? You know, what happens then? So there's a bunch of very, very significant questions, which, again, I think are not being asked. But it is a conversation that's quite often now in play. And because a lot of the older generations are sitting on these huge wealth pools, at least theoretical wealth pools, you can understand perhaps why they feel perhaps not guilty exactly, but they feel they want to help their kids, which is natural. And the kids are trying to get in to form a, you know, a family, and they can't because they can't afford to. So it's natural to try and find a way through. But I do think there are some traps here. And again, in my conversations, I've had a few people who've been caught out. By the way, I will just tell you one worrying statistic. The risk of default for first-time buyers who actually have got help from the bank of mum and dad in the subsequent 3 years is three times worse, because they won't necessarily have saved up. They won't necessarily have had the same discipline in terms of managing their finances. And so, you know, if you get a seagull payment, as I call it, you know, just dropping, like, buy a property, what it means is that you actually have less financial discipline, and quite often you can risk getting into more difficulty later. So it's just really important to understand that this is not a simple process. Oh, and by the way, in another conversation that I had some months ago, I was talking to an elderly couple who had actually done the right thing and had actually pulled out equity from their property. They'd remortgaged to be able to provide equity for both of their kids. But unfortunately, their own financial position deteriorated, and they found that they didn't have enough money coming through their own bank accounts for their own longevity. So they actually ultimately had to sell their property and effectively move in with the kids. If you do a bank of mum and dad arrangement, it's really important to formalize it sufficiently, to have an agreement so people are clear on whether it's a loan or whether it's not a loan, under what circumstances it would be repaid, et cetera, et cetera. Is there interest being charged, for example, or not? All of those things really need to be discussed. And unfortunately, it's literacy levels are so low here that people often end up just handing money across, or having a very informal, because, you know, people don't like talking about this, really. This has consequences, right? Now, let me just make one other point. Australia is interesting because there is no wealth tax on death in Australia. Governments around the world are desperate to try and find more tax income, right? Because governments are spending like drunken sailors. You know, look at the latest GDP numbers. You can see that the Australian economy was supported by mostly government spending, which is now just fading slightly. But it's a real problem. So governments around the world are desperate to try and find additional sources of income. Now, in the UK, there is an inheritance tax or death tax, right? Whichever you want to call it. Basically, there's a certain proportion of assets that on death can be transferred with no tax to a partner, for example. But beyond that, there are limits. And there are limits that, you know, it's a reasonable amount, but not a massive amount. But above that, you can be charged up to half in terms of tax on death. So what it means is, when your estate is actually administered, the first proportion will be effectively tax-free. But above that, the state will get half. So you can get around it by moving some assets early, 7 years early, but there are limits on how much you can move and to whom you can move them. So there are already in the UK limits. And this, of course, does have an impact on what people plan to do or don't plan to do. And quite often it leads to horrible conversations on the estate administrative side when there's a huge government impost that nobody actually thought about, right? Now, in Australia, we don't have that, right? On the main home, you know, in investment property, of course, you've got the issue of capital gains and things. But the interesting question is it something which the government in Australia might start to think about? Because they're desperate to find alternative new funding routes. And to my mind, this massive amount that's sitting in the theoretical value of property, it is something which, well, you know, looks pretty attractive. So I wonder whether there's, you know, somewhere some skunk work going on thinking about that. By the way, we could also talk about the unrealized capital gains stuff, another strategy, which is, you know, currently in play at the moment. I know that there's a discussion about whether the coalition will support an alternative version of it, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, the government's desperate to try and find other sources of income, right? Mm. And to my mind, this massive pool, it's again, the light on the hill. You know, they're going to think about trying to grab some of it. Because the problem is, once you've opened the door to it, you know, okay, it's on superannuation balances. It's 3 million non-inflation adjusted, which means that over the next 20 to 30 years, a greater proportion of people could well be pulled into it. But the problem is that it's on a theoretical movement in the value of your assets. You go from here to here, and then you have to pay tax on a proportion of that. But if it goes down, you don't get a refund. What you do is you have a loss that you hold until subsequent prices go up again. So if you were in the situation where, you know, asset values, for example, share markets took a dive and stayed down for a year, two or three, four, you would have paid a huge amount of tax potentially on a theoretical value that never actually accumulated. And normally, of course, in Australia, the idea is that what you do is you pay tax on transactions. So you buy and you sell. And if you make a gain in most asset classes, then what you do is actually pay a proportion of the gain in tax. But this is a theoretical, you know, messy way of trying to actually grab more tax. And I worry that it's opening then to a beginning of a wider aperture. Why just in superannuation? You know, why not out of superannuation? Why not the value of the family home, even, if you really wanted to go there? So I think this is a really, really important thing and should be resisted because I believe that it is philosophically very difficult to administer. It creates a really large amount of uncertainty in people's finances. And if, in fact, for example, if you had the situation where your superannuation balance was, you know, 5 million, but it was actually three properties, and you were forced to pay a significant chunk and you had no cash flow, what do you do? And the interesting question is, do governments want property prices to continue to rise or not? And it's interesting that through the last election, right, both major parties basically gave assurances to the population that, oh, no, we're not going to see property prices fall on our watch, right? Prices are going to continue to climb now, sustainably, whatever that means. And I come back to, it's not sustainable now, because if you look at that ratio we talked about earlier on, you know, 8 times income. And by the way, income now means 2 full-time income or more relative to what it used to be. You know, you can see how far we've come from a sustainable situation. And look, I don't think property prices will fall, but there's a risk they could fall. If we get a major recession, if we get a major crash, there's still a risk of that. But the fact of the matter is, governments have engineered this. This is bad policy over a generation or two. Mm. It's bad policy when they stop social housing and public housing, when what they do is they attract the likes of BlackRock and other international investors to build to rent. That's another flawed strategy in my mind that is not really going to solve the problem. We've got this massive, strong migration, so there's a very strong demand. There's a lack of supply. You know, we know all those reasons. Governments have stuffed up majorly here. And I would argue that this equity bubble that we're talking about, you know, is it illusory? Is it real? This is a result of this bad policy from government. There are some really deep questions here, and it is worth reflecting on those questions. Also, run the counterfactual, because, you know, you might think X will happen, but what happens if Y happens? Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high. Price discovery and price transparency are hard to find. And then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer.
I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.